Recently, police in a Connecticut town failed to use the state's red flag law to take a disturbed man's guns. Within days, the man killed himself and his girlfriend.
In August of 2022, she called 911 to tell police that he had threatened to kill her, to shoot her in the head. Police responded. They didn't arrest anybody. They didn't get what's called an emergency risk protection order.
That's Dave Altamari, an in-depth investigative reporter with the Connecticut Mirror. He gives us a look at the details of analysis by the Connecticut Mirror that finds uneven application of Connecticut's red flag law by local police. More to come after this.
With a podcast out there on whatever you're into, the news of the day may not always be your first choice. I get it. But with the WSHU podcast, After All Things, you'll be up to speed on the latest from Connecticut and Long Island in less than 15 minutes. So you can stay informed and get back to listening to what you love. Listen to After All Things with me, Sabrina Garone, weeknights wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Dave. You and fellow Connecticut Mirror reporter Jose Luis Martinez have done quite a comprehensive analysis of the uneven application of Connecticut's red flag law. And what is the red flag law to start off with?
First, I want to say this was a project that we did with a University of Connecticut journalism class. There were 12 students in the class who, frankly, did a lot of the legwork here. The red flag law, the state was one of the first that passed what is called a red flag law, where if police believe you have weapons, are a threat to yourself or others, they can get a court order to seize those weapons and make you appear in court. Connecticut passed a law way back in 1998 after the lottery shooting, and has updated it twice since then. And so, for years, I've been wanting to take a look at our law because it is nationally acclaimed as, you know, one of the best, to see how it worked and who was using it. So this was a good project to do with a group of students who could do a lot of the legwork.
To illustrate how it's being applied, you highlight the case of Michael Malot in Brantford. Tell us what happened there.
So Michael Malot was a dentist who was dating a younger woman, Caroline Ashworth. In August of 2022, she called 911 to tell police that he had threatened to kill her, to shoot her in the head. Police responded. They didn't arrest anybody. They didn't get what's called an emergency risk protection order. A few days later, Malo actually voluntarily checked himself into Mid-State Hospital in Meriden and told the staff there that he had homicidal ideations towards his girlfriend that he was fighting with and that he had access to weapons in his home. Under the law, Mid-State did what it was required to do. It notified the Brantford police that he was there and that he had made threats and that he said that he had guns. So that was a second opportunity that Brantford had to get an emergency risk protection order. All they would have to do at that point is check the state police gun permit database to see that he did indeed have, I believe it was 20 guns registered. And, you know, they could have gotten a warrant out of court and easily seized his guns at that time, but they did not.
And basically a couple of weeks later, he killed himself.
A couple of weeks later, and his girlfriend was released from a psychiatric facility early and 36 hours tracked Caroline Ashworth down and murdered her.
And then killed himself.
And killed himself.
Wow. Now, the law was meant to prevent these types of situations. And here's an example of police department having that information but not following through. Is that common, the analysis you made? Because I see that there's a discrepancy between Bridgeport, for instance, that has absolutely no record of police using this law. And I believe Meriden has quite a bit of use.
Yes.
What's responsible for that?
The legislature changed the law twice in the last few years. And what in effect it did is made it easier for police to get these RPOs, the initial intent of the law was that if you knew or believed someone had weapons, that you would get this, in effect, a search warrant, seize their weapons. The first change in 2021, basically, if police responded to your home, to a home, and someone was threatening to kill themselves or had made suicide threats, they could now get an RPO, even if they didn't think you had any guns, and make you go to court and appear before a judge. And your name would be put into the gun database so that you couldn't get a gun while that case was pending. So it made it, in effect, more of a way to help people who were suicidal and to ensure that they didn't get guns. And what happened is the number of RPOs went through the roof. After that law passed, the numbers from 2021 to 2023 have tripled.
And one of the places it's gone up is on the campus of the University of Connecticut. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, there is a significant disparity in how departments are using it. You mentioned Bridgeport in 2023 had no RPOs, issued no risk protection orders. Meriden, on the other hand, issued over 200. Brantford, ironically, after Caroline Ashworth was murdered, issued 139, which is the second most of any department in the state. What we found with UConn is that the department, anytime they get a call of a student who has threatened suicide or who feels suicidal, they were getting RPOs, and they had issued over 40 RPOs in like an 18-month period, compared to like all the other colleges in the state, which had issued about 10, all the other ones total. So UConn is clearly using it, and they acknowledge this, that it as a tool to deal with potentially suicidal students. Mental health is a big issue on college campuses, certainly post-COVID. And so they were getting all these orders, which basically then means the student has to appear in Rockville Court 14 days or so after the order is issued. And every single case but one, the judge dismissed the RPO because the students were all under 21, so they don't have any, and legally in Connecticut, they can't own a gun, and none of them had guns. But for the department's response to that was, it's a tool we use to, when we know that someone is potentially suicidal, it puts them in the system. It also puts them on the radar of the different mental health services that are available on campus. So it's worth the effort for us to use this as a way to try to curb potential suicide situations.
Well, you know, Michael Lawler, who was one of the architects of this law when it was implemented back in the late 90s, he seems to have a concern about some of the recent changes to the law, that they're unnecessary. Could you just tell us what his take is on this?
I think his fear is that the law now is potentially Second Amendment advocates could challenge it in court, that it's gone well past what it was supposed to be. Using his words, it was supposed to be a last resort for police to try to take someone's guns away. If nothing else was available, and they knew the person had guns, they could go to court, get this warrant, get a seizure warrant, and take the person's guns. Because at the beginning, you have to remember when this law was passed, it was in response to the mass shooting at the lottery, where the shooter was a disgruntled employee of the lottery, and basically people knew it, but no one did anything about it, and they knew he had access to guns from his parents, and there was nothing that they did or could have been done at the time. So this law was first passed to give police an option in a situation like that. So I think Mike's concern now is that we've gone so far in using it and that the increase has been so large that we are now potentially opening up a Second Amendment issue.
Now, is there any move to try and fix that now or
They did make some changes in 2022, but those were mostly cosmetic. There is now a part of the law that says you don't have to issue a RPO if the person is ineligible to get a gun permit in Connecticut. So in other words, anyone under 21, you really shouldn't issue an RPO, yet UConn has still been doing them. They changed some of the mechanisms of how it works. Initially, there's supposed to be two police officers that had to apply for the warrants. Now it's only one, because some small departments were complaining that it was a drain on manpower. And it is also, it's also a drain for the judicial department, because you have to have a judge on call, you know, in effect 24 hours a day to be available to sign one of these. And you also have to have, you know, the cases come to court and there's hearings, and you have to, a judge has to handle all the hearings. And there were over 2,200, I believe, RPOs issued in 2023, excuse me. Oh. And we're on pace for at least that many this year. And that number is three times more than it was just a couple of years ago.
But Steve Stafstrom, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, says there are no bills dealing with red flag this year.
I'm curious to see what happens, next year, frankly. I mean, the session's just about over now, and this, you know, the story's just popping right now. Whether there'll be some discussion of whether the law has gone a little bit too far next year, or if we have a challenge to it, some kind of a Second Amendment challenge.
Well, now that they've seen it in the story, maybe that will give them the idea that they can do something about this. Anyway, thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks, Ivan.
Long Story Short is hosted by me, Ebon Udana, and produced by Molly Ingram. Harriet Jones is our editor. WSHU's Alicia Daddario and the Connecticut Mirror's Gabby DeBenedictis are our digital team. This podcast is a collaboration between the Connecticut Mirror and WSHU Public Radio. We go behind the scenes at the home of public policy journalism in Connecticut. More can be found online at ctmirror.org and wshu.org. Our episodes can be found wherever you get your podcasts.